Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
I should make up for the little teaser about, if you know about feminist history, about Florence Luscombe. She was the first woman to graduate with a degree in architecture from MIT around 1916 or 17. And, you know, was in that young generation that was able to vote at the age of 21 in 1920, the first national election where women had the vote, and continued and was a leader in the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom her entire life. So, quite an activist and feminist heroine, or hero. I guess we get rid of the gender-specific verb noun forms now. So I thought I'd better fill that in for those of you who don't know about her. So I want to speak to you this morning of what a religious life means. And it's something that is in never-ending need of redefinition, and this is one definition for our time. To live a religious life is to live life in the belly of a paradox. And I don't think this is an impertinent undertaking in as much as religion is what people do in relationship to that which gives them meaning and value. It is not the private domain of the professional theologian. And whether or not one believes in a personal God or other sorts of higher power, one can still be religious. So what I have to say about religion applies to the theist or the non-theist, and certainly to many forms of traditional and not so traditional forms of belief and practice. And these words of William Lawrence Sullivan, who lives from 1872 to 1935, constitute my starting point. And I'll quote him directly. I won't correct for gender here. He said, "Here is a noble paradox. Religion tries to satisfy man while its essential purpose is to make him dissatisfied." To satisfy and to make dissatisfied. Well, Sullivan clearly knew this paradox. He was raised as a Roman Catholic in the Boston area, went through parochial schools and Catholic college and seminary, was ordained as a Catholic priest, and served as one for 11 years. He left the priesthood over the issue of papal infallibility, which historians of religion know was a fairly new doctrine promulgated in the mid-1800s and reemphasized by Pope Pius X in 1907, at the same time that he was condemning what was then known as modernism, which was applying the tools of science to religious faith. And Sullivan wasn't ready to accept the notion that the Pope was infallible or that science and other forms of knowledge did not contribute to religious understanding. So Sullivan became a Unitarian. He taught for a short time in the Ethical Culture School in New York City before entering the Unitarian ministry. Now, within Catholicism, he was a liberal, or as they like to call it in those days, a modernist. As a Unitarian, he was relatively conservative theologically. He insisted that Unitarianism had to be theistic, and rejected the claim that a non-theistic humanism could be religious. So he was on one side of the religious humanism controversy of the 1920s, and the people who were the predecessors of this congregation were on the other. But there was room for both of them in Unitarianism at that time, one of the strengths. So he defended modernism in the faith of his upbringing, and then drew a line at where modernism would take his chosen faith. So William Lawrence Sullivan in a sense, provides in his life an example of the noble paradox of religion. He left Catholicism for Unitarianism to achieve spiritual satisfaction, but then felt spiritual dissatisfaction as humanism spread within his adoptive religion. So I agree with him. To be religious is to be spiritually satisfied and spiritually dissatisfied at the same time. And therefore, to live a religious life is to live in the belly of this noble paradox. The noble paradox of religion is expressed in many ways. And by this, I do not mean varieties of religious belief. I do mean that there are many expressions of this paradox across the range of experiences, practices, and beliefs. And here, in brief, are just a few of these experiences, and I'll say more as I proceed. First, religion is concerned with, in traditional theological terms, the individual salvation. In more modern terms, even in much of Christianity, with liberation. And it is at the same time concerned with collective salvation, or what we might call social justice, or social liberation. It is the individual soul that is to be saved or liberated, whether by grace, by works, or in some traditions by non-attachment. It is the individual believes or acts not. Nevertheless, within the Calvinist, Roman Catholic, and Buddhist traditions, for example, there are strong concerns for social justice as well as for individual salvation expressed through individual forms of piety. So personal piety satisfies, but conscience dissatisfies. Religion preserves and transmits a sacred tradition. That's one part of the paradox. But at the same time, religion evolves and changes throughout its history. That's the other side of it. Religion shapes history, and history shapes religion. Religion values the inherited traditions and passes them on. You know, several of you who are on the board and have been in other meetings have remember that I've sometimes, for opening words, read a reading about the paradox of organized religion. Because religious institutions essentially conserve and maintain. However, a liberal religion is always challenging that. And when people gather together and let whatever spirit they live by move them, they challenge the status quo, even within the religious congregation. That's from Dan Hotchkiss's book on governance and ministry, where he talks about that. So religion values inherited traditions and passes them on. At the same time, it seeks to recover the ancient sources that have been obscured by accumulated tradition. And it also adds to the tradition by continuous development within the arena of history. It consciously strives to become truer in the light of newfound knowledge and new understandings. And some persons find this new understanding in the sciences. Others find it in mystical experiences. In short, religion is always staying the same even as it changes. The person who finds tradition satisfying will find change dissatisfying and even call it chaos. The person who thrives on change will be dissatisfied by the failure to change and call it being stuck. This can be the same person on different days or even on the same day. I have had UUs get upset when we've made small changes in the order of service they've been accustomed to. The traditions do matter. And don't have any coffee. Ooh. Yeah, I saw a joke. I saw this on Facebook this morning. A newly died soul goes to heaven and sees that there are Muslims there and there are Buddhists there and there are Roman Catholics there and there are Lutherans there and there are Presbyterians there, and they're over on the side are a bunch of people drinking coffee. And so the newly arrived soul says, "Well, I see all these different people there, but who are the people drinking coffee?" He says, "Well, those are the Unitarians. They're trying to decide whether they're really here or not." So religion celebrates the sublime beauty of life and at the same time reveals its harsh side, its meanness. That is engaged with the question of good and evil. Most religious traditions understand that good and evil are both real, but only a few, such as Zoroastrianism, hold that both good and evil have equal power in the universe. Most individuals desire the security of the belief that good is all-powerful. Even Unitarian Universalists, who even including the scientists, will sometimes take delight in quoting Theodore Parker that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. Even though as scientists, they may be convinced that the universe is morally neutral and has no intrinsic meaning. But the question is not simple, except in the purest abstraction, the question of good and evil. Life as we know it is beautiful, but it can also be mean. It can be good and it can embody evil. The assurance of beauty and goodness gives a person satisfaction. The awareness of meanness and evil makes a person dissatisfied. Another part of the paradox: religion is worldly and at the same time it is spiritual. It can be a guide to the practical living of life. It can also be contemplation of the ultimate or the divine, which may seem to be apart from life as it is known and lived. The answer to the question, how did the universe begin, can be absolutely decisive for a person's belief system or spirituality, or utterly useless in matters of everyday living, perhaps even useless for one's spirituality. Buddhism is not at all concerned with how the universe began, only with its recognition of how it is structured and exists, not why it exists or how it got to be that way. Religion is essentially spiritual and contemplative on the one hand, but is also essentially secular and active. The contemplation that satisfies and comforts the spirit can disturb the conscience. Yet the person whose conscience demands the satisfaction of righteousness and justice also needs the comfort and satisfaction that can be achieved through contemplation, perhaps, or communal worship, such as this gathering. In short, not only is religion paradoxical, but the religious person, the one who lives a fully religious, engaged life, lives in the belly of the paradox. Now, the word religion is derived from the Latin word meaning to tie up, as a ship is tied up in the harbor. Good start. However, as my late colleague Ralph Helverson liked to say, being tied up in a harbor is not what the ship is for. It is, in fact, only one half of what religion is for. To illustrate this, I want to turn to the biblical story of Jonah and the great fish, which most people say is Jonah and the whale, but it's really a great fish, a real big one. Now, Jonah was a Hebrew prophet. Like other Hebrew prophets, he spoke the oracles of his God, known by a wide variety of names, one of which was written without any direction to pronunciation, because it shouldn't be said. Well, Jonah lived in a time, which was the 8th century before the Common Era, where each nation had its own God. And the Hebrew people were very protective of their relationship with their God. Jonah was called by God to preach the threat of divine judgment to Nineveh, a city of Gentiles, that is, non-Jews, with whom his people had been enemies. Jonah was called to preach to them the threat of divine judgment, and with it the possibility of divine favor to another nation, to a people who had been his own people's enemy. This call threatened Jonah's understanding of Israel's chosenness. It galled him to think that his nation's former enemies might find favor with his God. Unwilling to carry this divine message to Nineveh, Jonah books passage on a ship going in the opposite direction, to Tarshish, and he is the only Hebrew on board. Jonah is sleeping below deck when a storm comes up. It threatens to sink the ship. Everyone but Jonah is praying to his own God, and the crew is throwing overboard everything that can be dispensed with, including the cargo, in an effort to keep the ship afloat. Only after the captain awakens him, only after the captain awakens Jonah, does Jonah realize that the frantic activity is going on. And by now it has come to drawing lots to determine whose God is angry and needs appeasement. Jonah loses the draw. He admits that he's been trying to avoid his obligation to his God. So the crew get ready to decide what to do. Well, they don't want to be guilty of the death of a prophet of such a powerful God that is tossing them about at sea. And they keep trying desperately to save the ship, but the storm only gets worse. So the captain and crew conclude there's nothing to do but heave Jonah overboard to drown. And as they throw him off the boat into the water, they pray not to their God, but to Jonah's God for forgiveness. The storm immediately subsides. The ship is saved, and Jonah is swallowed by a great fish. He is in the belly of the fish for 3 days until the fish spits him out unharmed on the shore near Nineveh, where he was trying to avoid going. Realizing that there's no way out of his divine mission, Jonah walks the rest of the way to the city. There he preaches the judgment of his God to the king and the people. Then the prophet goes outside the city to see what happens next. And much to Jonah's dismay, the king and the people repent of their wickedness, and God spares them from his destructive wrath. Meanwhile, God has made the tree shrivel that Jonah was sitting under because of his bad attitude. Jonah's really angry now. He's angry with God for showing mercy to his own people's former enemies, people who listened to his prophecy and repented. Needless to say, God chews him out for not caring for the people of Nineveh, for preferring to see them destroyed rather than saved. Jonah, in fact, has been so satisfied with his faith that he's greedy with it and doesn't want to share it. Jonah was in the most uncomfortable position when he was told to preach his religion to a people that he and his people had long regarded as enemies. The noble paradox of Jonah's religion was that the religion that had saved his people from their enemies was now to be given to those enemies for their salvation. The prophet who had been raised from among the chosen people was so self-satisfied that he refused to live in his own religion's paradox. Now, it may be too obvious, but I will say it anyway. Jonah's behavior did not compare well with the behavior of the others in this story. Now, I see this story of Jonah as a parable for all religious people, for it warns of the danger of becoming so dissatisfied with one's own religion, whatever it may be, that a person cares not enough to share it with others. It is a parable of pure traditional universalism. It tells of a God whose love is so great that no person is outside of its reach. But the story of Jonah, to me, is also a parable of a kind of universalistic humanism into which our historic Unitarian and Universalist traditions have evolved. The paradox today is that a free faith such as ours encourages each of us to seek his or her own spiritual satisfaction. Each of us makes his own path or her own path. But at the same time, it encourages us to enable others to have that same satisfaction. Unitarian Universalists are committed to the religious and spiritual freedom of each and every individual, not just those who gather in our meeting houses. Therefore, many Unitarian Universalists say we don't proselytize, but that's getting too smug about it, and it's not taking the effort to share. For as the Unitarian theologian James Luther Adams put it, a purely spiritual religion is a purely spurious religion. That is to say, it also requires the action to share the blessings of it with others. And for many times, that takes the form of social justice, but also of inviting people in who might find a home with us here. So I would argue, along with William Lawrence Sullivan, that religious practice and spiritual sensitivity must lead to both spiritual satisfaction and spiritual dissatisfaction. If a person is truly spiritually concerned, he or she will never be satisfied with himself or herself, for the need for more growth is inescapable. If a person is truly spiritually concerned, that person will be dissatisfied with the world as it is. Awareness of how suffering and injustice deny not just spiritual satisfaction to others, but also their freedom and ability to survive, can only plunge the religiously aware person into a state of severe dissatisfaction. So there we are in the belly of this paradox. And as you and I grow in our understanding of the meaning of life, a number of things happen. We enjoy life more because we can more deeply and freely appreciate its joys. We're more content with life because we see the significance of the good and the evil in the lives we live. We are less content with life because we see the significance of the evil and the good in the lives we live. We are more certain of ourselves and our actions because we see and appreciate our own growth in understanding. And we are more critical of ourselves and our actions because we have a clearer understanding of the world and our place in it. In short, we grow more satisfied and dissatisfied as we deepen our faith. Confidence in a belief or in the direction of a movement in faith may lead to satisfaction with one's religion, but never to satisfaction with how we live that religion. When you or I feel the most self-satisfied, life just might swallow us up whole and spit us out in a strange place. It does not take a belief in Jonah's God or any other deity to know that this sometimes happens. So let us never forget that a religion that neither preaches divine judgment nor gives easy answers is able to provide spiritual satisfaction alone. If this were so, would we not be gathering here this morning? We are here because we need this shared space, this faith, this religion of ours. Shared worship is one way to get clearer about what life means and how we should live it. A sense of spiritual security can be our anchor in our harbor, but still the insights of the Spirit lead us and enable us to go forth from the safety of the harbor. We know that we grow and change over time, and we know that we are not isolated individuals. We know that our spiritual responsibility is not limited to our families, our co-religionists, or ourselves. Therefore, we cannot help but be dissatisfied with a world that deprives others of basic elements that enable us to enjoy our free religion: adequate food, clothing, and shelter for the body, freedom of speech, and assembly for the spirit. This is why we are here as well, to be made more dissatisfied with the world as it is. Our religion satisfies and it dissatisfies us. So to be religious today is to be acutely aware of the paradoxical reality of existence. To be religious is to live consciously with the world's joys and possibilities, and at the same time with its threats and sorrows. To be religious is to refuse to accept glib answers to the question, why? It is to be involved in the awfully disconcerting and awe-filled business of living a life of meaning in a world of constant change. Now, perhaps a little more than others, perhaps more than I should, I enjoy living in the belly of the paradox. I am both energized and challenged by life's contradictions. I love the journey of life, even when I am sure of anything other than the final destination, which is death. However, I admit that there are times when I yearn for the security of the harbor. But the security of the harbor, as Ralph Helverson said, is only one half of what religion is for. And so I live with enthusiasm in the belly of this noble paradox. For me, the religious life is satisfying and dissatisfying, both often at the same time. In our free religion, in Unitarian Universalism, this is what it means to be a religious person. We are constantly challenged, and so we change. We grow as individuals, and so we change the world. The world changes us, and we grow as individuals. Satisfaction, spiritual or other, goes hand in hand with dissatisfaction. This is life in the belly of a paradox. It is not easy. Sometimes it can be painful, but it sure is good. And I welcome those who have joined this congregation this day to join with the rest of us in this noble and disconcerting life.